But we're here to talk about powerful and independent boards of directors, and how do you know what when you see it? I'll tell you a little story that relates to what Kathy does. Doesn't have a good ending, but it's an interesting story. Marianne and I, in March, were making a sales call on a public company. And the CEO, it's a small cap public company, and the CEO wants to sell some technology to large retail organizations like Walmart and Walgreens and Target. And what it does, it allows poor people to purchase products and these people would not normally qualify for credit cards. And he has some sort of heuristic where he can look at somebody's financial history and identify within this poor credit risk area who are the best of the poor credit risks. Not a very attractive business. But you know, money's money. So could we put together a board of people who's just by the fact that they're on the board will get investors interested in the board because the whole product line just has kind of a negative kind of distasteful image. So we've done work in the aerospace industry, and they often have generals and admirals on the board. And there's two things what happen when you have a general and admiral on the board. One is it gives the Department of Defense a kind of a warm and cozy feeling that, you know, a bunch of generals and admirals would not allow crap to go and be used by service people. Just wouldn't do it. Second is when stuff hits the fan, the generals and the admirals usually have the private phone numbers of key people in the Defense Department so they can make informal calls and sort of get around the formal system. So I've been doing some work with a former attorney general, and I thought, you know, there's a lot of similarities because there's an association of attorney generals, and they meet and talk and they bond and they have this collaboration, an informal collaboration with each other. So I said to this potential client, I said, I know what we can do. Just to give your company a panache, credibility, we're going to put together a list of former attorney generals and associate attorney generals at the federal and state level. And then we're going to find people who are extremely well connected. And those are the people that we're going to target. And more important, since your ultimate consumer is usually going to be a minority person, we're going to really focus on getting women and minorities. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was a brilliant idea that I had. And so I went to Kathy. I said, okay, I've got a brilliant idea. Now you make it happen. So Kathy got me a list of every attorney general, associate attorney general at the federal and state level, and she got their power position from 0 to 100. And it was very interesting. Edwin Meese was on the list. Edwin Meese was the Attorney General for the United States under Ronald Reagan. He's got like 25 on a 0 to 100 basis point. Probably he's retired and he's kind of out of the scene. But there was a guy named Garcia from New Hampshire, from New Mexico, who had an 85. And I said, you know, these are the, you know, the Garcias of the world, with the Hispanic names, are the ones we're going to really target, particularly if they have 80 and higher, which I thought was very cool. I could not have done it without Kathy, and we didn't get the business because. But the fact that we could think that way and come out with those numbers is what Kathy's value is, and that's what she's going to talk about. Let me introduce Kathy. Her area of expertise is behavioral finance. She received her BA in China at Nankai? Mm-hmm. Nankai University. She had a PhD at the University of Alberta in Canada. Where's the University of Alberta?
Edmonton.
In Edmonton, okay. Yeah. She's Associate Professor of Finance at Suffolk University's Sawyer Business School. And she's going to be discussing some technology called the Personal Power Index, and you're going to take this and put it on.
Right.
And you're going to take that. Thank you.
Right. Okay, thank you very much. It's really nice to meet you. I came to Boston last year and been really excited about what Boston has to offer, and I actually started to think about what Bostonians are thinking about, which is to be an entrepreneur. So I'm working on two startups. And very recently, I also put my first seed round financing to a other startup company that I'm really excited about. They're really talking about becoming the next Google, and they wanted to move to San Francisco. So I'm doing my part to keep them in Boston. So if you're interested, I really would like to talk to you about what they're doing, and it's really has a lot of potential to become the next to become the next Google. So, anyways, I've been working in the area of behavioral finance, and today I'm going to talk about behaviors in the boardroom. So imagine that you have a board meeting, and you tend to get a collection of different types of board members in your room. Some could be quieter, some could be louder. And so I guess to start, I can throw a question to you and say, which kind of directors would you like to see on your board if you were a CEO of some of each? So what's the proportion? Do you want the louder ones to dominate? Do you want the quieter ones to dominate? Do you want it to have an equal portion? What do you imagine to be the most effective dynamics in the boardroom? And we're talking about how you pick your words. Do you sort of say it very politely? Do you think imprudence is fine?
I think the quiet ones need to outnumber the loud, aggressive ones 3-1, otherwise they're going to get drowned out.
3-1.
Slightly different nuance. If I recall correctly, in the Stephen Covey book, Habits of Effective People, he talks about the behavior seeking to understand before you position yourself to persuade, so to speak, where you try to advocate for something. So, with a third person, who does that?
That does serve as a judge. Or?
Well, I mean, someone who is a effective listener in the first instance, and then persuasive once the facts are surfaced.
Very good. Very good.
That's a second that, because I think a thoughtful, quiet person, but a person who then can come out with a point of view that people listen to, that they follow through, they listen to what the facts
are. Right. So it's a mixture of a knowledgeable person who's speaking out, basically.
Yes. So my experience with board members, many of them open up the material that has been sent, read it just before the board meeting, and then close their mind just after the board meeting and think about something else until the next board meeting. So they're not informed. Many of them are not informed, and therefore are unable to contribute, especially outside board members that aren't part of the day-to-day operation of the business. And I think that's a real weakness that we have in our board. I think the strongest board members, the independent board members, are those that are really up there in terms of what's going on and can contribute and can criticize, but respectfully criticize when they believe that something is going on.
Very good point. You're getting to...
To me, maybe different words, but I look at it as passion. Mm-hmm. You can have people that are passionate about outcome and local, and you can have people that are, you know, thoughtful listeners who feel passionate. And I think you want passionate people who really want to listen and learn. But where you started with, wow, if that means disrespectful and disruptive, then we don't want any of those. I want to get them. Because it creates problems that are beyond the problems that we bring to the table.
I have one of the problems is that board members are there on behalf of shareholders, not management. But they get to know management, and they don't get to know the shareholders. So you have this like disconnect of familiarity with what management wants. You know, they really are there for the shareholders, and that builds tension. It's important
not to lose sight of whose interests they really represent.
Yeah,
I think also I have a friend that did her dissertation on related parties on the boards.
Okay.
I think she can take it the next step.
Right.
And she found out that people that didn't know each other on the board were 23% more profitable.
Right.
More profitable. The companies were more profitable than those that knew each other.
The more
people on the board. And I've had three friends that I've gone on to the board. Well, I know they're not going to raise their hand and say the other viewpoint. They're just going to either keep quiet in some instances or not disagree. But if you have people that don't know each other, they're more apt to disagree with the viewpoint.
Or at least ask questions.
Right.
Yeah, very good. Ellen.
So I think we've all said it. I think it's not about loud or quiet.
Mm-hmm.
It's about directors who are fully engaged.
Right.
Who listen,
mm-hmm,
at times, who speak at times, who engage other directors in a very respectful, passionate way. So it's elements of everything you said. I don't think it's loud or soft. It's other elements that really drive it, right?
Yeah. Very good.
And just to add one more piece, that the engagement is critical, but also knowing what business you're in.
Good. Yeah.
And some of them come to the board, they have no clue what you're really talking about.
Good. Yeah, so a lot of you mentioned this point, which is that in order for you to say something, you have to know it. Right. So, and a lot of times, it's not that you know one particular thing. A lot of times, to make very intelligent decisions, you might have to know a number of different things and be able to come up with innovative solutions to a problem. That.
Add one thing, which is that we've all been to meetings that are well run versus meetings that are poorly run, and it's somebody's responsibility to run the meeting, and it's that person's responsibility to make sure that the people who don't speak unless everyone else is being quiet get a chance to speak when everyone else is being quiet. And those people that maybe speak a little too often get tamped down a little bit, and that's part of good chairmanship over meetings as well. So you can have all the personality types, and everybody can be passionate, but particularly retired military, by the way, they're very well trained. They stop talking. And they will not start talking again until they get the floor. And it's very important to create an environment in which people who behave that way also get to speak.
Right. Very good. So related to this, another question is that how often do board members have to say that, wait a minute, this decision that you're proposing, this new project that you're proposing is really off the limit or it's really not sensible. So how often do you see in your experience as a board member that you have to disagree openly?
Do you mean disagree or do you mean question? Because I think all too often board members do not question enough,
mm-hmm,
necessarily. I don't know if I agree or disagree, but is this really the right direction for us to go? To even open up that discussion, I find that doesn't happen as often as I would like to see it happen.
We had a program here, I think it was maybe eight or 9 months ago, I think you were here.
Mm-hmm.
Mick Bain, who was with Wilmer Hale, spoke about a case that's going through the Chancellery of Delaware, where a private equity dominated company made a decision to sell. And then there was a class action shareholders lawsuit. And the defense was, well, the board made that decision, and the board had independent directors on it, and the independent directors agreed with that decision,
Therefore, this was in the interest of the shareholders. And the retort was, they were not independent directors. They were there. They were nominated by the private equity company. They owed their seat to the private equity partner. They may have been legally independent from a Sarbanes-Oxley point of view, but they weren't really independent. And so that's at least, you know, 4 or 5 months ago, that was making the rounds. And it's interesting, I'm curious, you know, are you familiar with that case?
I've heard of the concept, not the case, but I was going to say, one of the problems with Keller, just because you're independent, let's say under the rules of the stock exchange, or management, you have to do independent analysis. But it's like it's monetary, it's fairly rigid. That does not mean, if you point out, that you're truly independent. And that could either be the best buddy, although maybe just a walking buddy, of the private equity partner, or similarly, as I've seen, maybe you're really a nominee of management. So you're technically independent, but you're there because the CEO likes you, and you may be perfectly competent, but that doesn't mean you're truly independent.
And usually those are the two alternatives. It's either you're a venture capitalist or private equity, so you have a you're representing basically your company that is invested in this company, so you're not
and that's a
or you can think by the CEO to come under the board.
And that's a classic where a director is a nominee of a shareholder and hence has an inherent conflict, and particularly when it comes to sale of the company, you've got to be very, very careful.
So, Kathy, just to come back to the asking question.
Yeah.
I think the question you asked was, how often is there conflict or is there
right.
And I guess, again, I might phrase it a little differently, which is, management presents a something, whatever something is, it should be provided in advance. Directors have a responsibility to have reviewed in advance and fully engaged in advance, and to come with appropriate questions, input, whatever the topic is. Obviously, it depends on what the topic is. But the directors have a fiduciary responsibility to delve in, to ask questions, not running the company, but to really delve in an appropriate level. So there's got to be constant interaction for you to have an effective board, and really the issue is you've got to be able to have that interaction with the style that works so that it can be kind of a constructive resolution.
Very good. Very good. Yes. So I've been doing some research that uses a power measure that takes into account a person's access to information and a person's ability to get things done. And basically what I've found is that if you have a board that's dominated by these very powerful independent directors, things seem to be going really well in all sorts of aspects. So on the top level, your market valuations will be 6% more controlling for everything else compared to companies that do not have the powerful boards. And into more details, it appears that the companies that had more powerful boards seems to have better decisions in distributing their cash flows. They have better decisions in pursuing M&A transactions. They have their accounting looks cleaner, so there's less incidence of earnings management. Their executive compensation is more meaningfully tied to performance metrics, and their underperforming CEOs seems to go a little faster. And so on. So the list goes on. Basically, the idea is that it seems that these people really bring some value to the board. And as Alan suggested, it could be that they are doing more due diligence. It could be that they know more. It could be that they were more capable of voicing their concerns, they're more willing to engage. So we've been trying to find a way to quantify this and say, if I were to find a good board member who could do all of this, where do I start? Right. So the next question is, how do we sort of find people that are like this? And there are actually some interesting research preceding what I was doing, which is that sometimes people say that we videotape all the conference calls, and we use these voice analysis tools to see the to find a CEO who has or a board member who has a baritone voice. there's another study that says, you know, in Sweden, we find out that the CEOs, the CEOs are actually 1 centimeter taller than the average man in Sweden. So people have different ways of saying where does power come from. And coming from China, our leader of revolution, Chairman Mao, said, well, power comes out of the barrel of a gun. Doesn't work in boardroom.
You obviously have not been to the mullahs.
So where does power come from? So we're trying to find a way to say that, okay, we know that the board members work better if they have the information. Where do they get their information from? So there were some studies that look at the west end of Boston, the Italian communities in the 70s, and see how they evolve and collapse. And what they find out is that the Italian communities are extremely tight-knit. So you really can't sort of talk to anyone unless you're good buddies with one of the families. And once you know one family, this family will take you to dinner parties with the other five families that they're closely related to. And you always go to the same party with the same host, with the same people, and it really comes into a click, right? But the problem that the researchers find out is that it's impossible for them to learn anything new. So they don't respond to any kind of mass advertising. They don't respond to any kind of TV commercials or flyers that you put under their doors. And so as you can see, the way that their knowledge is very limited, right? But they have a very cohesive community, but it's very, like, people really support each other, and you have all the loving and nice things of this community, but people don't have the information. So I'll show you the first picture that we're looking at. So the first picture here shows you some sort of communities. So the big picture here is a sort of a bird's eye view of the social networks of U.S. business professionals, executives. And you see that there's the centers with reddish circles. So the more red the circles are, the more CEOs you have in those circles. And as you can see, some circles have a lot more CEOs, and some circles have much fewer. But most of the time, the CEOs are sort of in the center of the network. The lines and the little circles that's attached to the middle are what we call leaflets. So they were related to the most powerful, most center people in the network, but they were not close. So they were a little further out. Okay, and the outer rings are the people who are hanging outside. They're not connected to the center. So you can see some sort of cliques, and the difference is that those are very large groups. So even though you see them in small circles, this picture alone has about 300,000 people. So these circles are not that small. So I talked about one aspect of being in a very cohesive group. The other aspect is that you have to have an arm outside of your group.
Right.
So those are the people that we consider as bridges. So even though you are fully embedded in your community, you know everybody, and people trust each other, people love each other, and yet you have so-called weaker connections to the outside. And that's where you get the most information, because if you've been with the same people for 5 years, you know everything that they know, right? So the next important part of being an important person in terms of gaining access to information is that you needed to have weak connections, weak links to outside of your comfortable circle. So the pictures, the most colorful pictures I have here shows a 2-degree connection of one of the most powerful board members in the American business landscape, which happened to be Alan Richloom. And so basically, if you see the small dots near the center, that shows the sort of the cliques, the close connections, the tight connections that that Alan has. Apparently, these are about 260 connections in the database, but I'm sure Alan has over 500 or even more.
And your database only looks at board members of public companies.
Right.
Alan probably knows more than that.
Right. Well, the database itself do not necessarily have just board members, but they have lawyers, hedge fund managers, accountants. The center here is where you gain the most support. So those are your close allies. But on the other hand, you also go out. So for example, if you Alan would have a connection to this Larry Velocity down here. There's this big red flowerish, and this person, he himself has hundreds of connections. So through him and through the other persons who has large connections, you see the fan-shaped connections. This network, if you can guess, how many business people, how many executives are here? And basically 1 degree removed. So Alan knows this person knows the next person. So
are
two
you
steps.
How many people are represented?
Yeah,
by this?
So how many people are represented by this? If you can give a number.
100,000.
Okay. All right. Any?
Well, pitching 6 degrees from
No, it's only 1 degree.
Just 2 degree. 2 degree. Yeah. Yeah, 2 degrees. Mm-hmm. 15,000 is what's plotted here. 15,000.
50?
15.
15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15.
Yeah. So 15,000 people are represented here. Yes.
I have a question on the list of the bronze.
Uh-huh. Right.
So why is Larry's farm longer than, say,
the
blue one,
the right one.
There's no name.
So
what's the reasoning for the longer? Is there a mathematical reason for that?
Well, they needed to. It's not particularly. Yeah. Yeah. So, anyways, what you're seeing here are these bridges, the bridge points, the ones that leads to the big fan out. So that makes open really opens up your opportunities. So people when people were asked for your next job, where do you get the lead? About 15% says it's our friend, but the rest basically says it's acquaintances. It's the people who are not really close, but we know. Right, so that's how people get their jobs. All right. So if you go back to the second picture that has names on it, you can see that I put three people into their clusters. So apparently, Alan and Neil and Dan, they come from different parts of the network. So
I know who Alan is. Who's Neil and Dan?
I think they signed up, they didn't show up.
Oh, Neil, okay.
So Ben is this COO person at the 3D printing company.
Yeah. He was here last.
Yeah, and I think Neil was the one that works for a entertainment company.
Okay.
So even though they were all fairly close to the very center, very core of the network, but they come from different parts of the network. And so having connections between these parts makes them very important. All right, so now we have one last picture. So the last picture is about the concept of neighborhood cohesion and the strengths of your close connections. So here, Alan has first of all, most people have this is called a K core. So most people have a 19 core, meaning that in their network, they were among one of the 19 people who knows at least 19 people. So it's a going around connection. So most people have. So I'm talking about this peak here. So out of this 300,000 people network, we find about 7,000 times where a person belongs to a fairly small core of 19 people, where the 19s are fully connected. So it's a very tight group. And here I plot Alan to be pretty far left on the tail, which is, so her K-core number is 114, meaning that in her network, there are at least 114 people who has at least 114 close connections. So it's a much larger core. Your close community is much bigger than the average person and their core community. Yes?
So do I take away the more connections you have, the more powerful you are in a board room?
So
different than effectiveness in a board room.
So we're talking about two concepts here. One is how connected you are,
yeah.
And the second is how central you are in the entire network. So if you go back to the previous picture, you can see that some of the red parts, they were a lot more central in the network compared to the little white dots that are outside. So one thing is about you have to form relationship with a large number of people, but if you are simply forming relationships to the people who are around here and here and here, it doesn't make you more powerful. You're far out. You're outside of this
I crack at answering your question.
I'm having trouble with the two dimensions.
Right.
I think, if I'm correct, what Kathy saying is there's a relationship between the diversification you have of your networks,
yeah,
and the degree of power that you can have. So, for example, if there are 18 people that I know extremely well, and two of them happen to be on this board, I have to be very careful about alienating those two people. The practical example, if Bain & Company puts me on a board and my only contact in the private equity world is that one partner at Bain that brought me in, I have to think three times before I contradict him on something important. Something small, maybe, but if it's important, then I got to be very careful. On the other hand, if it's Ellen Ridgestone, if she gets that private equity partner angry, it may ruin her day, but it's not going to ruin her life. So I think that gives her more independence to say no to someone of power. Is that?
Yeah, that's a very important part of it. Yes. So when you are.
Is that? Yes. No.
You know what? I can disagree with you, but not offend you. If I am thoughtful and if I know the subject and I present it in a rational, logical way, we can agree to disagree on there. So that I also can know a number of people, which means that as I go out of a boardroom, I'm able to communicate and link to a wider range. I guess I was trying to understand the definition of power. Because I was, at the beginning, I was going that power meant I could be persuasive and be a leader in a board situation. I'm having trouble now on that, but I'll catch up.
I think Kathy's definition of power, which you're talking about, is summarized with social network power centrality. That's what she's saying. The more connections that CEO and board members have, globally effective, meaningful connections with people that are in the decision-making process, the more effective they're going to become, and the more highly respected they're going to be. And I agree with you. I mean, my mother told me to kind of disagree without being disagreeable, whatever those words. That works nicely in a board environment. One other comment is, I would say that about 90% of the major decisions are made usually, especially if you have a good CEO, whether he's chairman or she's chairman or not, are made outside of the board in advance of the board meeting, which we agree with that. It's discussed. The people that are going to push back are known. Changes are made, compromises are made, usually in a good board, and then when it comes up, it's just to ratify from the people that have power to delegate.
Also, sometimes I'll have a dinner the night before, so everybody can kind of relax together and get to know each other before the board, and things will come up. Better feel for what's happening, the CEO and the executive chair.
Are you suggesting cause or effect? In other words, what you're showing here is that powerful people have lots of connections, but is that because they're powerful? Maybe that is their type of, that they themselves, need to have the connections because they're a good leader and think they need that, as opposed to
So that's a very good question. The power comes from this idea that as you progress in your career, you become more and more important. So for example, you run bigger companies. You get to know more important people. Yeah, so we've seen examples where an 80-year-old executive could be really low on the power scale after 55 years of on the job of a CEO for a small company and doesn't move. And we've seen much younger people who really climb the ladder, be very successful, become more and more important. So when you move from job to job, it really depends on which way you're moving. If you're moving outward, then your power number will definitely go down. But if you're moving towards the center.
There's a dimension that we haven't talked about here. And I'll preface this by saying that I don't have experience working on boards, but I have a lot of experience working on investment committees,
mm-hmm.
which I think behave somewhat similarly.
Mm-hmm.
That's the dimension of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And without a group where there really is a high level of trust mm-hmm. among the members of the investment committee, you can achieve something that we used to call a positive tension. And it required the sort of thing you're mentioning like at the dinner beforehand to test out issues and so forth. You could confront them in real time at the meeting and nobody felt threatened because everybody trusted each other. And again, I don't know if that's a property of boards or not.
The best boards I've been on, they have. You're never going to have it perfect. There's always going to be somebody who needs that rain back here. But if you have a really great board, you've got people who will create the positive tension, that disagrees in the right way, the right question. It's prevented only in the sense of they've read the material, they've engaged, if they have things that aren't yet in the material, they mm-hmm. reach out, they make sure the CEO or the chair of the board knows there are things that aren't in the material, that have shown up.
Mm-hmm.
But decisions are not made ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Not if you have a really solid, good working board, in my experience.
It seems to me that you'd want a board that is comprised of people who do not have a lot of social or professional control over each other,
yes.
but bring to it particular expertise. So, for example, in a technology company, you might want to, you're going to need somebody who knows finance, you're going to need somebody who knows the technology, you're going to need somebody who knows the marketing, commercialization. And when the opportunity arises, those people ought to be able to speak up, and people ought to defer to them, provided it makes sense. So power is also comprised of building a board so you have the range of expertise you need. So various perspectives come into play as the conversation occurs. I also think that's important
mm-hmm.
because what happens if you don't have experts in different areas, you can have meaningless conversations where if you don't have the expert to lead the conversation, which is very, very important.
I totally agree with Ellen. I think if you have a highly functioning board with people who trust each other, the work actually gets done in the boardroom. There's other work that gets done outside the boardroom, but you don't have to do the whole socialize everything, you know, stroke everybody before they get in. You can actually just have straightforward, straight up conversations, differences of perspective in the board meeting.
Related to the different expertise, we actually did some analysis. So if we look at small companies, the bottom third of S&P 1500, we actually see that your board members needs to come from different parts of the network. And if they all come from one circle, then things are most likely not working. So this diversity in expertise and their diversity in their social positions does help, particularly for smaller companies. I wanted to ask another question. You are all mentioning about this very gentle disagree type of situation. I wanted to pull it to an extreme where the CEO is really messing up and he needs to go. So how does the board work it out so that you can sort of come to agreement to make this very difficult.
That's what executive sessions are for. Right. Together without the management team, and you agree on what has to be done, and then you go make it.
Right. You also do a lot of meetings before the meeting. If you're the one that's advocating, then you manage to make sure that you answer all the questions and you have your rationale prepared for each of the board members. So when you come in, you have that executive meeting and you can carry on a thoughtful discussion.
The much harder question, which you didn't ask, is what happens when some of the members of the board think there are other board members who need to retire? The executive session doesn't help you, and that's when all the work has to be done outside of meeting, because I just actually navigated two members off my board in order to bring Ellen in and do some other things, and that was all work that happened outside the board meeting because they were in the room.
Good. 2 minutes. Of course,
I mean, along the post board, you have an audit compensation governance committee. Have any of you seen a governance committee that really effectively evaluated fellow board members and acted on it?
Yes.
Good. Now, how does that work?
Works fine. Exactly as she says. If the governance committee actually does help the board go through an evaluation or help board members go through a self-evaluation, and then that is part of the governance committee's data. The governance committee can meet and say, maybe we ought to have a meeting with Larry and see if he really wants to continue on the board or not.
It's not that difficult. Board self-evaluation is one of the few things I've ever done in my life where you accomplish what you set out to do before you do it. Once the board sort of says we're committed to external board of director self-evaluation and we're really going to do it well and we're going to have an independent person run it, it's an open secret about which board members are not performing.
Yeah.
Everybody knows, just nobody talks about it. And what we've found is once the board has made this decision and once the external experts are hired, the poorly performing board members announce that they are retiring. Mm-hmm. And then there's a going away party and then they get a nice gift for their services.
Exactly.
And this is before we even start. And so once we start, the work is done. But it was the board making the commitment that we're going to be serious. As long as the board self-evaluation is, our CPA firm gave us a questionnaire. We're going to pass this around. We'll spend 5 minutes and evaluate ourselves. If it's going to be that way, it's not going to work.
Yeah. That's right. It has
to be
and
real.
And then if each board member gets feedback about how they perceive on their fellow board members,
right.
And it's objective feedback, they usually make that decision.
Can I pursue that question a little further? Because I guess the only time I've ever seen that done well, maybe it's just my experience, has been when the governance side met you an outside firm.
Yeah, right. That's what we're saying, yeah.
All right. No, an outside consultant who really, and then all the information goes outside, evaluated outside. It's just my experience. Is that the most
important? Just to throw that in, we did with smaller working board members without a formal outside evaluation. It was just clear that the rest of us knew who had to go.
Okay, so that's good.
The
chair. So you had term limits in their terms well? No?
No. It was just time.
That's a very convenient thing, though, term limits.
Yeah. Ideally, and it seems like that would be a little bit of elbow pressing or, a little influence there. But I had a client that had that same situation, and what he did was he addressed the board because he was strapped for money and really couldn't afford an outside service to come in, although I think he would have loved it.
But he said, you know, I need to have the expertise around the table to help guide this business. We don't understand the business at all. And they're here because they have a symbol in their, you know, entourage of networks and so on. And they're really just figureheads. So I need people on my board that will come and participate, be engaged, be open, be thinking, and work with them. So what we did was we identified roles. And it became very clear that the simple things like a job description were necessary. What is a treasurer? What is, you know, secretary of the board? What do they do? How will you feed into that role and make it worthwhile? Is this something that you really want to do? Or perhaps you know someone. And so he got voluntary, you know, resignations that way, and he also was able to broaden the network and bring in the expertise that he really needed.
Let's have one more comment and then we'll be
sure. Only that I know that we're coming up to six. Do you have an article that you've written on this?
Yeah. You can send it to everybody if...
Thank you.
It's a very good book written on directors called The Director's Handbook, written by Tom Dougherty of Scanton. A lot of books that I've read on director duties tend to be very legal and very abstract. This one is particularly practical, designed primarily for public company directors. Author is at the Scanton Boston office. I missed the author.
So my paper is Powerful Independent Directors. If you search that, it will pop up very easily. Powerful Independent Directors. On Google, it will come out. And before we leave, I'd like to give a round of applause to the star of the show, Alan Richardson.
Well, I did exactly. I did it 4 years, and they said that together. Next thing I know, he got a call and said, guess what, we texted you. So, well, I did follow. <laughs> Well, when I first met Kathy, and she was explaining his technology, I said, well, let me test this out. And I gave Ellen's name, and I gave somebody else's name. And so my prediction was Ellen would be in the 90s, and the other person would be in the 20s. She's 96. And that was before Ellen got on another public company board, so I suspect her scores have gone up. This technology has also a lot of value for those of you who are in companies where you have sales forces, and you're trying to sell to a fairly high-end group. Because once it becomes a software as a service, you can be at a cocktail party and be talking to somebody and then discreetly go on your iPhone and then find out what the number is of the person and from that time, let me go somewhere else or continue asking me to buy the person a drink. Thank you very much, Kathy.
Thank you.